I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Desert Isolation Discs. My guest today is a giant of modern journalism, and for many has defined what writing about music should be. Using witty and personal prose, he has covered every significant rock music movement over the last three decades, from their epicentre, from Riot Girl to grunge, for titles including Enemy, Melody Maker and The Guardian. He was there at the creation of Alan McGee's creation, and his career has been defined by his close relationship with Kurt Cobain, whom he introduced to Courtney Love. Born in the UK, named Gerry Thackeray in 1961, he's known by pen names including The Legend and, most famously, Everett True. He speaks to me down the line from Brisbane, where he runs online music magazine Collapse Board. Gerry, hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm great, thank you. Absolute pleasure to speak to you. The concept of the podcast, as I'm sure you well know, is that I've catapulted you into the desert, into isolation, and you've got to pick eight tunes that you will have to live with. So quite a big task for someone who's had such a close, you know, your life is defined by music.
Yeah, well, considering this list, there are a couple of songs that immediately suggested themselves to me. Also, I have a tendency to take kind of lists like this a bit too literally sometimes. So if I'm not careful, I'll sit there for years trying to figure out how I could narrow down like 100,000 songs into, you know, a list of eight. So initially, when I started doing this list, my idea was just to ask my wife what her favourite song was from each of these artists, but she saw through that idea kind of second song in. There are so many notable omissions from this list. You and me could talk about the notable omissions for the next few days and we still wouldn't have touched on all of them.
Fantastic. And I think that's time for another podcast of a three-day list of omissions then, Gerry.
Yes, maybe not.
So what's the first pick?
OK, so I've got Nina Simone, Trouble in Mind. I saw her play live a couple of times. She's always been my... I don't have favourites, you know, you don't have favourites. It's not a competition. You take each song as it comes. But having said that, Nina Simone's always been my favourite. I have probably, I don't really know, about 50 or 60 vinyl albums of her back in the UK, 20 or 30 CDs. And I saw her live a few times, not as many as I would have liked to have done. One occasion that particularly stood out was in Minneapolis in about 94, probably, when myself and my friend were the only white people in the entire audience, which was quite a turnaround for me to be in the minority like that. And it was mostly notable for the fact that she was on stage for about 40 minutes and 30 of those minutes was the audience singing along. Nina was able to kind of mix emotions up and kind of... just confused people just by being there. You know, she was political when people didn't want her to be political. She was absolutely part of the civil rights movement. Mississippi Goddam is such an incredible protest song. I play that one to my students pretty much every single semester because, you know, it's Nina. I play several other songs of hers as well. But anyway, this particular song, Trouble in Mind, it was kind of early on in my love for Nina. Kind of I came to her pretty much the same way a lot of people did in the UK in the late 80s. I heard her version of My Baby Just Cares For Me, loved it. Got it on 10-inch from Rough Trade on Charlie Records. Don't mention Charlie in the presence of Nina. Famous story, she once chased the owner of Charlie Records around his office with a knife, demanding that she pay him the money owed. Anyway, I bought that record, and this version of Trouble in Mind that I really love is on one of those cheaper albums that used to come out. I can't remember exactly what they were now. Music for Pleasure, I think. A Golden Hour of Nina Simone. And it was her playing Trouble in Mind live, just a gorgeous piano refrain. What, you know, when she's just going out to entertain people, there's no kind of agenda, just her enjoying herself. And I think it was probably one of the first songs I played Charlotte, who's to become my wife, when we first knew each other. You know, and it's one we bonded on, and it's just a song that makes me feel good.
Fantastic. Well, it's one that I love as well, so let's hear it. Nina Simone there. Now, Jerry, your record collection is actually in storage in the UK, I believe, and you've moved to Australia. Did you do that on a bit of a whim?
No, we didn't move to Australia on a whim. We went to... You can't really move to Australia on a whim. You don't just step on a random plane and you somehow find yourself in Australia. No, we knew we were going to move to Australia, but we thought we were going to Melbourne, but we stopped off in the north on the east coast on the way because it's winter and it was a beautiful day when we stepped off the plane, so we stayed in Brisbane.
And can you tell us about your life there? I mentioned Collapse Board and also your teaching.
Yeah, I'm a PhD student. I've been a PhD student for too long. I'm studying the effects of online environments on music criticism. You know, what is the role of the music critic when everybody has access to music the way they do themselves? And, you know, when everybody's like, you don't need criticism anymore because, you know, you can just go and listen to it. Which is totally missing the point of any kind of arts criticism, because that was never the point of it, not really. Aside from that, we've got three kids who are 9, 5 and 3 who are wonderful and infuriating the way kids are. They kind of take over your life. You don't play that much music when you've got three young kids because you just don't need the competition as far as noise is concerned. Quite often I will go to bed a few hours after everybody else because I'll be listening to music on my headphones, but that's not that good because it means I don't fit in with everybody else's day. I don't go out to shows anymore because I'm 53 and I've got three kids and I just get tired, to be honest. And I don't really like going to shows I've never liked going to shows as a consumer. I've always wanted to be a participant, so, you know, I did that early on without realising, by always dancing to bands down the front of shows. Then I carried on by being a critic and kind of giving reviews and doing my fanzine, obviously. And then, you know, I was performing myself, I DJed. But now I'm in Brisbane, I kind of, beyond Collapse Board, I don't really do any of that.
Yes, absolutely. I can completely relate to that, and I think it's good to feel an active part of something.
Yeah.
What's your second choice?
So the second choice is Dexys Midnight Runners. Listen to this. Now, again, this is a song that's special to me and my wife, absolutely. Dex is famously, I believe... I once threatened to punch another journalist because he told me how much he loved the Dexys. Not how much he hated, how much he loved them. We were talking about Dexys and we were exchanging our favourite songs and he was saying, I love this, and I was saying, I love this. He was saying, I love this, saying, I love this. And then he said, I love this. And I said, you have no fucking right to tell me that. So I tried to punch him. With Dexys, it's kind of more devotional. There aren't that many bands I'll allow myself this with. Most bands, you know, I'm a critic to a degree. Most bands, somewhere down the line, I will not allow myself to become that devotional to a band. But there are some bands I am. Nina Simone would be a good example. Dexys is a great example. It's when I say devotional, it's kind of like, I guess maybe it's what people get out of following a football club or something. I don't know. I don't experience that kind of sports urge or going to church or something. I feel a very strong connection with their music, which has become even stronger since I actually met Kevin, which was quite a few years ago now when he was living in Brighton and I was, because I realised that he's, you know... I mean, obviously, he's a very different person to me, but he's very insecure in his own way. He's very kind of, you know, and that's probably something that I can very much relate to within his music. Listen to This is an amazing song because it's a love song. It's a very straightforward love song. He sings I Love You over and over again. And it's an amazing song to listen to if you believed in Dexys as much as I did at one point and still do. Because on their first album, he's got a song about... how basically I'm not going to give myself up for love, you know, and believe in all the bullshit and all the lies like all the others, you know, and he has this big diatribe against love, and he has this line, compromise is the devil talking, and then on this song he starts off, well, I was thinking of a compromise when I saw the beauty in your eyes. He's absolutely referring to the same thing. You know, I can understand why people would be into things like Dylan or Van Morrison or you know, whatever, their classic rock. I mean, for me, that's Dexys. I was thinking of a compromise when I saw the beauty in your eyes and hiding something in me, so I say so.
Was Dexys Midnight Runners. Thank you for that, Jerry. Now, I mentioned at the top there that in many ways your career has been defined by your relationship with Nirvana, and obviously you were close friends with both Kurt and Courtney Love. How do you sort of, having written a lot about it, to say the least, since that time, how do you separate your real life memories of being with Kurt and the kind of the myth and folklore that's emerged around him, and that, you know, the fan obsession that's obviously been exaggerated as well in the internet era?
I'm not sure I can. I haven't got that good a memory, to be honest. I can't remember most anything from the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, the noughties, the 10s. I've just never had a very good memory. Maybe that's why I write about stuff, I don't know. The only artist since, not that I've listened to that many, to be fair, but the only artist since Kurt's death that I've actually heard get Kurt was Lord on that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame appearance. I thought that was astonishing. She absolutely... You know, she was so nervous, she was trembling from head to toe. I know that's part of her shtick, I'm aware of that. But even so, she was absolutely, you know, it was herself. She was so vulnerable. And that, it was that vulnerability at the heart of Nirvana's music that made them so special. Because otherwise, you know, they wrote great tunes, they had great, you know, riffs, and they had all of that, they had a great voice. But, I mean, there's loads of bands that have that. But they had that vulnerability that so many hard rock or whatever, or pop bands don't have. You know, they're not willing to... it's not about willingness, it's just they had it. So that Law performance was something quite magical to me when I saw it. I was like, wow, you know.
And how would you... how would you describe your relationship with Kurt? Clearly, you know, both, you know, you were a journalist but also his friend.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, how do you classify a friend? I have no idea how you do that. I don't know. Other people have told me that he was my friend and I was his friend. I mean, I guess that Rock and Roll Hall of Fame thing, actually, which I did watch because a couple of people... Because I like the idea they chose female vocalists. That was the first time I've really kind of been like, oh, yeah, those guys, yeah, they were... Yeah, I miss those guys. I miss Chris. I miss Dave. I miss, you know, the guys around them that you wouldn't have heard of. Yeah, it's a shame I'm not in contact with them. You know, why do I have this thing in my life where I just don't stay in contact with anybody that I used to know?
Well, we're glad that you're in contact with us. Now, your next track is Beyoncé's Crazy in Love, isn't it?
You know, when I first mentioned a few years back that this was pretty much my favourite song of the last 10 years, people on Facebook actually thought I was taking the piss. They thought, you know, they were like... And some people, like, instantly unfriended me. And I was like, what? But this is, like, one of the best songs of the last 10 years. I mean, so obviously, it's got so much energy. It's got more energy. It's louder than pretty much any rock track I can think of. The reason I like it is one word, euphoria. Euphoria. It's euphoric. It's absolutely. It's just so full on and so wonderful, and so I can still remember seeing it on Top of the Pops in England and Beyoncé walking out, stepping down those steps. I've only heard it a couple of thousand times, so you know I could probably stand to hear it a couple of thousand more times.
Beyoncé and Jay-Z with Crazy in Love there, Jerry. Excellent stuff. Tell us about how the music press has developed during your time writing about music. You set up Careless Talk, Coslize, an absolutely fantastic magazine, starting out at issue 12 with the issue of with the mission of counting down to zero and the target of either having changed the British music press or having to give up. What's your attitude to how you did that project?
It just seemed a sensible thing to do. At any given point, we were about £30,000 in debt on that magazine, and I didn't even realise that until after the magazine stopped and we just about broke even. We never got paid, you know. We were doing it as a kind of full-time job for 2 years. It was me, Steve, and Andrew Clare, our designer. I mean, there's tons of other people, obviously, but we were the main three who were kind of putting the magazine to bed each couple of months. And that thing about counting down, well, it's partly because we felt that people didn't and still don't take music criticism seriously enough. I mean, music criticism at its height can easily be the equal or even more life-affirming or whatever than the music it criticises. It was, I'd just come back from Australia, been in Australia for a year. I was going to start up a satirical magazine via a couple of ex-loaded people. It kind of fell through for one reason or another, but then I was still talking about doing a magazine and Steve kind of came in. We just wanted to put out as good a magazine as we could. The fact that Steve Gullick was doing most of the photography for it really made me raise my game because I was just like, oh, shit, I'm going to have to write something as good as his photographs? How the hell am I going to do that? And because I was writing it for myself and because I really wanted to take pride in what I was doing, I was really pushing at the boundaries of what I thought I could and couldn't do in my writing. You know, we deliberately started off with that Mogwai feature in the first issue, which was about 9,000 words long and written by about 6 different people. I don't know if anybody really caught on to that. And, you know, we had that ridiculous Songs Are Higher one where I didn't even meet the fella. I interviewed Steve Gullick. He went out to Chicago, and I interviewed Steve about experiences. I wrote that in something like 3 hours, the whole thing from beginning to end. We had the Nick Cave interview where Nick was just so nice, so sweet and accommodating, and it was quite alarming. I think it might have been the first time I met him, although Nick actually ended up being one of the very few people who used to come along to see me play live in Brighton because he knew one of my bandmates. I was proud of it. I was still doing something like that. I wish I'd got paid for something doing something like that. I still think there should be an anthology of it. But Jesus, the amount of money it would cost to put that out, knowing what Steve Gullick's kind of production values are, it's just, you know, it's just scary.
Well, I'd buy it. So what's your next Desert Isolation disc?
Yeah, Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers, Morning of Our Lives. This was... I decided that when our first son was born, Isaac, who was born in the UK in 2005, when he was born, I'd just bought a four-track tape recorder a few weeks before, a month before, and I decided I was going to record a song every day for the whole time he was growing up. Now, of course, that never happened, but I did actually manage it for about 3 months. Made up a song every day, recorded it... just using the bare... I can't really play guitar or anything. And the second song, not the first song, because I was a little bit tired after he was born, but the second song I did was Morning of Our Lives with my friend Chris Anderson. The song I always show my students is I was dancing in the lesbian bar for the dance break. I remember I saw him in Seattle in a tiny pub. No one seemed to appreciate him there because he lived quite close by, I think. And he did a... like, whole dance in front of us for, like, 10 minutes. It was just the best thing ever. He was meant to be the first person ever to dance to the Ramones. I don't know if that's true or not, but I like to think it is. He was also a very big Velvet Underground, very early Velvet Underground. But Jonathan Richman, a dude, you know, I mean, you could pick about 100 songs of his and still not tire of any of them.
Then there's no need to think that other people can do things better than you can do them, 'cause you got the same power in you. I got faith in you. Sometimes you don't have it in yourself, but I got faith in you. And our time is right now. Now we can do anything we really want to. Our time is now. Here in the morning of our lives.
The inimitable Jonathan Richman and the Modern Lovers there. Now, Jerry, you're an Essex boy by birth, aren't you? What were you like as a kid?
As a kid, I grew up in Chelmsford, Essex. I can remember when they built the dual carriageway through the middle of it, which just absolutely killed it as a kind of town. I was only about 9 or 10 when that happened, but I can still sort of remember it. I remember after I left home when I was 18 or 19 and I went back, every single time I went back, which was every few months, it seemed to be completely different. They seemed to have knocked down a load of stuff, put up a load of stuff. Now, I guess it's another satellite town of London. When I was growing up, my dad was a councillor and it had an identity of its own. Whatever that was, I don't know what it was, but it had, you know, and it was home to Essex County Cricket Club, which I used to be a cleaner for. I was a very shy kid. I come from a family with 6 children. I was 4th. I kept myself to myself. I just dropped out of the kind of conversation. I got bullied a hell of a lot when I was at junior school. So when I came to senior school, I realised there were 2 main ways out of that. First was to make friends with the weirdest boy in the class, you know, who's also tough because no one was going to mess with you then. And the other way was just to kind of get in more trouble than anybody else, which I did. Not nasty trouble or anything. I was just... Sorry?
What did you do?
Oh, just, you know, just stupid stuff. Moving desks around during lessons, you know, just, you know, whatever. Setting people's doors on fire. I realised I would either have to like punk or change my friends, and I wasn't very good at making friends, so I kind of... We formed a band, actually, before I even kind of... I think before I even bought a record. We had a band which kind of did that whole thing of shoving guitar strings under... shoving drumsticks under guitar strings, playing piano, decks of cards used as percussion, you know, just homegrown recordings. Actually, scarily similar to the kind of stuff Daniel Johnston was doing around that time. Daniel also learned to play piano from the same book that I learned to play piano from, which was the Beatles songbook. I'd never even heard the Beatles, I just liked their songs. And even to this day, I think that some Beatles songs are just completely wrong because they do not do them like me. My versions are way better, which I think is kind of one of the reasons I like Daniel Johnston so much.
What was your band name?
Sorry?
What was your band called?
Oh, my first band was called Blowjob. I was pretty naive those days. And my friends told me it's because I blew down a recorder. So I wrote the band's name all over my school exercise books and I got given detention.
Very dubious. So what's your next choice?
Yeah, so the next song... Now, the next two songs, actually, I've chosen. I'm aware that I'm on a desert island, OK? And I'm aware that if I've only got eight songs, and I don't know how it would just be eight songs and why there wouldn't be a time limit on them, I better choose a couple of songs that go on for a little while. Otherwise, you know, I'm going to be... If I chose, you know, I wanted to choose a Renette song or a Ramone song, but they'd be over in a couple of minutes. And although it's fine playing that song for 10 times in 20 minutes, you might as well play a Can song, and that's going to last 20 minutes anyway. You do right. I'm not... You see, Can's interesting. I like Can just fine. I actually like the band's Can influence more in many ways. I mean, I love The Fall. I never realised how big the Can's influence on The Fall was, probably not until the last 10 years. I never really heard Can. You know, I heard bits of them, but not really. It's kind of the same with Velvet Underground. It was... I heard bits of them, I like what I heard. So we can, I still don't really know their discography, I just know this one song, You Do Right, which pretty much invented about 30 genres of music and about 3,000 bands. But yeah, You Do Right's just like, it's the greatest rock and roll song ever written, and it's also incredibly long.
Well, we may have to play you a truncated version, but here we go then, the greatest rock and roll song ever.
Once I was blind, but now I can see. Now that you're in love with me, you made a believer out of me, babe. You made a believer out of me. She said, do, I do, do, what? She said, do, I do, do, what? She said, do, I do, do, what? She said, do, you do right. She said, you, it's alright. She said, you, it's alright.
That was Can with You Do Right. So, Jerry, you told us about your punk days. How about your family and your relationship with them?
I was sort of the black sheep of the family, sort of. I come from a pretty religious upbringing. My eldest brother's a priest. All my other brothers served as altar boys. I didn't because I was chief choir boy. And, you know, they've all... I think most of my family still got pretty... My mother was a chaplain. And I think most of my family still got pretty strong connections. When I went off to college, which I only did very briefly, I didn't really get on with college, I got to Goldsmiths College in London, the maths department, not the art department, the maths department, and I discovered that London had a lot more record shops than Chelmsford. Chelmsford actually had a lot of record shops at that point in time anyway, but London had a lot more. I spent my entire grant, this was back in the days when they gave you money for going to college, I spent my entire grant in the first 2 weeks for that year, and had to sell most of the records back again a month later. I ended up squatting at the end of that year because I had no money to pay for accommodation. Much to my, I think my mum was pretty concerned. It was a pretty bad area, to be honest. It's called Mugger's Corner. We used to get raided fairly regularly. Some guy OD'd in the room next to mine. And then I kind of, I had no idea what I was doing. I ended up being a really, really terrible screen printer for 7 years. I didn't have any qualifications. I didn't have any clue. I started writing about music by accident, kind of. I was passionate enough. When the enemy started printing my stuff, I don't know. It's not that my parents weren't supportive. My brothers and sisters were kind of teachers and bank managers and accountants and stuff, and I wasn't. But then all of a sudden, all my relatives and everybody, they knew who I was because of Nirvana. And all of a sudden, when we'd have the family reunions, which I would reluctantly go to, my uncles would be referring to me as the famous one, and, you know, my cousins would be wanting to know me.
And what was writing for The Enemy like at that point?
Yeah, at The Enemy, while I was there in the 80s, I was a freelancer, as the legend. A lot of the other freelancers didn't like me because, quite rightly, they thought I couldn't write. I couldn't write, they were quite right. I really didn't know how to write. I couldn't string a sentence together most of the time. I made up words because I couldn't think of the right words. I'd use lots of exclamation marks because, you know, I, whatever. I guess they kept me on because I was pretty good at, spotting bands, being enthusiastic. I had a unique voice of my own. About the only people who really supported me there was Stephen Wells, mainly because I think Stephen felt, you know, I was from fanzines and so was he, and I performed on stage. I guess other people did, you know, there's the Alan McGee, the connection that didn't hurt, so that probably gave me a lot more licence than I realised at the time. Oh, anyway, so I ended up kind of having a very brief affair with this female writer, and one of the first things she said to me was, she said, "Why don't you ever talk in the office?" And I was like, "Well, that's because why don't I ever talk? Well, that's because I kind of disagree with most of what people say." And she said, "I just thought it's because you're boring." You know, I went in there because it was fucking Enemy. It was cool to sit in there. And I was a freelance screen printer for the last few years I was there. So it was somewhere to go, you know. But then when I got sacked by the Enemy, you can't really sack a freelancer, but I got sacked. I went over to the Melody Maker, and I can remember very early on going down a pub.
Why were you sacked, Derek?
Why was I sacked? James Brown, who is a fellow fanzine writer, we used to actually write for each other's fanzines, me and James, and John Robb, the big three we used to call ourselves, Attack on Bizag, The Legend, and Rocks. James Brown got brought in as features editor, and one of the first things he did was come up to me and said, "Jerry, you're lazy, you can't write, and you're useless. You're sacked." So I went to the Melody Maker, where they like journalists like that, and I typed up three sheets of paper saying everything that was wrong with the Melody Maker. And when I went in for my interview with Steve Sutherland, he started asking me questions. I just handed him these sheets of paper. He read them and he said, "Okay, start. You're in." Early on, maybe one of the first few weeks I was there, I went down the pub with the other guys, the other writers, and I was standing there just watching them all drinking and talking to each other and still feeling like I couldn't talk to anyone. And I went up to David Stubbs, who's the guy who did Mr. Agreeable, very funny guy, very personable, but a little bit more sensitive perhaps than other. And I said, "David, you seem kind of, you know, okay. How is it you can talk to these other people and kind of, you know, what's the secret?" And he said, well, he looked at me, he was like, "Well, just drink. I was like, oh, okay. So that's what I did for the next however many years. I just drank, and then I very quickly realised that in the world of rock and roll, where, you know, you get considerable cultural cachet from being fucked up, the only trick is to get more fucked up than anybody else, and that's really not that difficult.
But a vital skill to have, nonetheless. So tell us, what's your next choice then, Jerry?
It was an immediate choice. It's not one I regret or anything. This Heat, Health and Efficiency, band from Deptford, Camberwell area in the early 80s, rough trade band. Saw them one time supporting the Slits and some skinheads, a big skinhead contingent at gigs back then, who were arguing with me and the bloke standing next to me. They were heckling this Heat. We were telling them to shut up because we liked him, we wanted to see him. And one of the skins produced a knife and just knifed the guy next to me. They were kind of called prog punk in retrospect. Nobody would have said that at the time. Just ferocious, just there's so much going on in this song. It goes on forever. It's very repetitive. It's kind of a comfort song. It's a comfort song. It's there because I know it will provide comfort.
This Heat with Health and Efficiency there. So, Jerry, how do you approach your writing these days then?
Well, look, I mean, at this stage in my life, I mean, I'm hoping this will change at some point, but there are two main places I write for. One is Collapse Board, which is for myself, unpaid with a very small readership, and the other is for The Guardian. And so The Guardian... You know, I mean, you know yourself, you know, writing for broadsheets, you know, you have to follow a certain kind of set style. You know, I'm a Guardian reader naturally, so that's not a problem for me. I do find it difficult writing for publications I'm not a natural reader of. And I think that's often the trick when it comes to being a freelance journalist, to find the publications that you would naturally pick up anyway. You know, you start writing for other people and you start kind of trying to second guess what you're meant to be doing. With the Guardian, it's interesting because I write very much in a similar way to the way I conduct my research. You know, I with those articles, what I will do... I mean, I'll give you an example. I got a message from one of my editors just before Christmas. Joe Cocker had died. Could I do a story about his Australian connection? Now, I'm not necessarily a natural Joe Cocker fan, but, you know, I'm not going to turn down some work, and it seemed like an interesting story. And so first thing I do is you go online, you chase up every single lead you can following that story. So you've got about 30 different windows open, and then you kind of start making notes on each of those windows, and then you kind of start closing some of your windows, and then you narrow it down a little bit more, and then you narrow it down. Then you try to find maybe a couple of sources that can give you some kind of unique kind of perspective or quote that you wouldn't get from anywhere else, and then you kind of work that in. You know, if you're reviewing stuff as opposed to doing an article or feature on something, if you're reviewing stuff, you try not to look anything else at all. You try to just go with whatever thoughts in your head. You know, you're working on a computer, the rest is down to editing. You know, I'm a good editor, I always have been a good editor. So you just kind of follow whatever space your head is in at that point in time, and you kind of if it's not working, you still try to go with it, and maybe you can come back. It depends. I work better on a deadline. You know, if I'm given 2 hours to do something, I can do it. Give me that job, I can do it. We used to have a competition at the Melody Maker to see who could write the fastest album reviews. I was able to turn 4 around in an hour, including listening to the albums. And they'd be, you know, just as serviceable as anybody else's.
Sounds like you must be a fast typer as well, Jerry. So what's your next choice for us?
So my next choice is Edwin Hawkins Singer's Oh Happy Day. And this is actually one that I've gone on record as saying it's the best performance ever recorded to vinyl. Not necessarily the best song, but the best performance. It's just, I love gospel music up to the point where it became kind of, you know, overtly kind of homogenised or codified or whatever. You know, when the whole point of me of gospel singing and the whole and the reason why Whitney Houston's an awful singer and Nina Simone's a great singer is because it's not about hitting the notes. It's about trying to hit the notes. It's about the passion you put into it. It's about the energy. I don't believe in a God myself, but I love the fact that other people do. And music. Oh Happy Day is a song I picked a while back because you've got to choose a song for your funeral if you're getting older. It's a song I chose because it's completely inappropriate. One of my favourite ever, you know, absolute favourite memories of Plan B magazine was being invited out to Istanbul to DJ. I mean, that in itself is pretty incredible. And I DJed in front of this completely sold-out, packed house of about 400 or 500 people. How the hell? I don't know. And putting this song on and the place going absolutely berserk with myself leading them in the dancing. It's just, you know, it's just one of those kind of... You don't need E or anything, you know. I haven't spoken to Alan McGee for, what, 30 years? I don't know, a long time, since we fell out in 85. He's not the type to go, but he falls out with people, I fall out with people, so when we both do it, it's like, it's not going to happen. We did have a bit of a run-in a few years ago on Twitter when I commented on something that Sean from Down and Sound, I think I was defending Sean from Down and Sound from McGee having a go at him, and I said the difference between Alan McGee and myself is that he thinks people still care about what he writes. He was doing Guardian column at the time, and I said, I know people don't care about what I write. And he wrote back and said, no, Jerry, the difference between you and me is £30 million, which I thought was pretty good. So I wrote back, no, Alan, the difference between you and me is that I don't need to take drugs to enjoy music.
That was Oh Happy Day. And you mentioned your wife, Charlotte. Jo, how do you share musical tastes, and where did you meet?
We met in a nightclub in Brighton. Well, roughly. I mean, Brighton's not that big a place. We're sort of the same circles and we kind of knew each other. But the first time I noticed her, she was smiling at me in a nightclub in Brighton, and she just had a beautiful smile. And I was like, she can't be looking at me. She's way too beautiful. I'm not sure she was, actually. Were you looking at me at that point? No. She says no. We were part of the same scene, really, which kind of centred roughly around a few different nightclubs, the Free Butt, the Basement, a handful of others, you know. It was kind of shared musical to a degree. I've got way better taste.
What's your final choice, then?
So the final choice is a full track. Now, the full track I've chosen, I'm only 90% certain of the title because I wasn't able to triple check it just before you called, is Hotel Blodel from Perverted by Language. And it's got Brick Smith singing on it, which is perverse, like the fall. Yes, I have, pretty much. I have a lot of Fall albums. I don't think of myself as a Fall fan. I mean, you know, I've got 30 or 40 Fall albums, but I really don't think of myself as a Fall fan. Because there are Fall obsessives out there, and I'm not a Fall obsessive. I just happen to have 30 or 40 albums, and I happen to like pretty much most of them, certainly the ones I've heard, which is probably about 20 of them, 25 of them. But I'm not an obsessive, you know. I don't read interviews, I don't read books, whatever. I've only ever seen The Fall a few times, actually, a handful of times. I had a great moment, having said that, I had a great moment in Melodymaker in about 91, 92. We used to hold these in-house debates where we'd invite kind of, you know, pop stars and personalities and industry people to come and talk about the pressing subject of the day. And we had one about, I can't even remember, it's about independent music or something. There was something about independent music, you know. And we'd invited a whole bunch of people to turn up, and they all turned up, which was lovely. And we had a couple of unexpected guests show up, which were Mark E. Smith and Peter Hook. And they came into the room, and I was chairing the debate. And they stood either side of me, each with a hand on my shoulder, like they were kind of passing on the baton. It was quite surprising. I didn't know either of them. Still don't. It was lovely. I wish somebody got a... Maybe somebody did get a photo, but I've never seen that. You know, The Fall, I mean, they are my own can, you know?
Yeah.
You know, I bought their... The first album I ever bought was Live at the Witch Trials. And it's still... You know, it's bound to be. I still think it's about the best album ever made. Yeah, and all the you know, everything up to about 90 or possibly after that, and then some of the stuff after that, and then some of the stuff from the 2000s, and you know, the last couple have been pretty good as well. But no, I'm not a fan. No way.
Well, since you're not a fan, we'll just have to enjoy it in spite of you then. This 19th century conflict sparking off, I repeat, these southern spectres with disease rhythm, dusty, organic, and psychic. How do you think you would cope in the desert then, Jerry, if you were cast out there alone? You've got your 8 records, do you find
be shade?
Yes, there'd be shade.
Oh, well, it'd be like living in Brisbane then.
So you're fairly adept to it.
Yes and no. I mean, it depends whether it's hot all the time, and also it's not so much the heat during the day; it's the cold at night.
I'm sure you could keep dancing to keep warm, couldn't you?
In the desert? I don't think I need to keep dancing.
We're very generous here. We give you the Tiger Who Came to Tea and the complete Red Dwarf box set, but you're allowed one extra luxury item. What would it be, Joe?
Well, I suppose it depends whether I was going to be kind of constructive with my time and whether I was going to get off this desert at any point in time. If I thought I was going to be getting off the desert at any point in time, I suppose the most sensible thing to do would be to take some kind of writing device so I could write. As long as I thought someone was reading it, going to read it at the other end.
I'm sure we'd find it. I'm sure we'd pick it up.
So maybe just a humble pencil and... I prefer a computer, you know. Just, you know, whatever.
We'll throw in a pencil sharpener if we give you the pencil then, shall we? It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Jerry. Thank you for letting us hear your Desert Isolation discs. Check out collapseboard.com where Jerry's writings can be found. And thank you for joining us. As ever, any resemblance to any other podcasts, alive or dead, is purely coincidental. And we hope that you can join us again next time on Desert Isolation Discs.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.